Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hi, welcome to the latest Driven Chat podcast. How are you doing? We've got a bit of a fun one for you. And I think one of the most brilliant things about this is that the caliber of people that you're about to hear from, they're fascinating, they're dynamic, they're quirky and interesting. And they all have two things in common. The first one is they are fabulous artists. And artist can mean anything. It can mean car designer, sculptor, photographer, painter, whatever it might be. The second one is they love their cars. And that's why they're on the Driven Chat podcast. I'm Andy J, and I'm handing you over quite literally to the main pair, John and Amy, because these are three conversations. Although I was at the Sleeping With Art, these were recorded at Sleeping Art exhibition, and you heard from Rio Cam last week, who we all loved.
Yeah.
And those of you that listened to the radio show as well will have heard from some of our other friends like Renata Fernandez and Helen Stanley, who were also at the event. But these are three chats that John and Amy had without me. I was off supervising some stuff with the Bentley, which was really fun.
You're doing lots of busy things.
I was doing lots of busy things.
Busy man.
Doing lots of busy things, running around like a blue-arsed fly, as they say. But nonetheless, I miss these chats, which I really wanted to be part of because these are really cool people. You chose three great people. It's one of those things where we said at the start, okay, who's cool? And there were like 70-odd artists there doing lots of different things. And these are just, I mean, there were lots of amazing people that we couldn't talk to as well because we were so busy. But these three are really special. So guys, who have we got?
Okay, yeah, we'll fire straight into them. And the reason we wanted to say a quick hello between, or both before and between each chat, we've got three amazing conversations that you're about to hear. It's because I thought, a bit like we did with Rio Cam last week on last week's podcast, I gave you the opportunity to just have a quick look at his Instagram account whilst we were talking to him. Because, of course, when you're talking to people that create visuals, it's nice to see the visual aspect of what they do. Mm-hmm. And if we were doing a podcast with Amy Shaw Photography, I'd be telling everyone to get onto Amy Shaw Photography's Instagram and have a look because, of course, you can see the kind of work we're doing.
Yes, so it's also worth saying, just very quickly, John, sorry, and then,
I'll let you
give the artist out. Those of you that are kind of listening going, well, hang on, we're here for the cars. Car service resumes again next week.
Yes.
And actually, there's a very special, I don't want to say too much about next week's podcast because I don't want to ramp up too much pressure, but it's going to be one with a certain blonde member of our faculty will be bringing to you from a special facility, and I can't wait to hear it. And it's very carsy, like very carsy. If you don't want art,
carsy is an interesting choice of word. It's very carsy. If you heard that out of context,
well, it's got lots of car and car-based chat.
It's quite nerdy,
mechanical, nerdy, oil and grease.
Yes.
All of that jazz. Anyway, yes, sorry, back to the artist. The first artist that you guys are talking to is?
So it's his name is Jean-Yves Tabago, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly. I'm sure Jean-Yves will tell me if I've not. Now, as you'll hear from this conversation, which I won't do too much of a pre-build-up because Jean-Yves will tell you the story himself, ex-Williams engineer, and Williams as in the people that build the most iconic racing cars, turned artist, but in between was responsible for building Andy J's favourite Bond car,
yeah,
the CX-75 Jaguar, the baddies car from Spectre.
Which is amazing.
It is.
It is amazing. I really would love those to be on the roads. Imagine seeing them everywhere. That'd be so cool.
Absolutely. So we'll dive into that. If you happen to have in your hand your phone or if it's somewhere nearby and providing it's safe to do so, have to say these sort of things, JYT_bespoke_art. That is the Instagram account to follow. If you're struggling to find it, go onto the Driven Chat account and you'll see it there. JYT_bespoke_art and listen to this conversation where you hear about the art that Jean-Yves is creating and as well as the amazing involvement in building and running Bond baddie cars.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital.
Well, hello. It's John Markar here, and I'm joined by Amy Shaw, and we're still here at the amazing Sleeping With Art Festival. Andy J has stepped away to go and do some filming with a rather special Bentley, but we have found a replacement voice, and he's one of the fantastic artists here at the event, Jean-Yves Tabareau, who is an automotive artist, and we're going to focus on that. But the crucial reason why we've grabbed you here, Jean-Yves, is because of your involvement in the automotive world. So you are, in your title, you were the car build manager for Williams, which is a huge job title to have. And you've also done really exciting things in the world of films as well. So firstly, welcome. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for accommodating me in your beautiful pod.
Yeah, it is an interesting little space here. We're in a pod recording pods at this wonderful art festival.
And the sun is very good too.
The sun is good. Yeah, for the UK, this is a good September. And we're very happy. We're just going to keep our fingers crossed it's going to last as long as possible, because all of a sudden it's going to become autumn, and then that's it. Christmas is here. And
woo! Anyway. Well, no, thank you so much for coming along.
Well, thank you.
So when did you hear about this festival, and what did you think when you first were told, hey, do you want to have your art in this thing called Sleeping With Art? What did you think?
Yeah, we've been talking with Renata. I was one of the first to say yes, actually, cool. Not knowing at all what was involved. But and I like Renata. She's fabulous.
She's
the
cool
energy, she's so cool. And so I said yes straight away. But initially it was going to be in July, which worked out quite well.
Yes, that's right.
And now it became obviously back-to-back, coming back from the Revival, where I was also exhibiting. So that was a little bit more easy.
Yeah.
But in a way, all the paintings stayed wrapped up. So so it worked out quite well. And I don't live that far, so it's fantastic. And it turns out to be such a good event.
Mm. It really is.
The weather helped, but still. Yeah.
Just such an amazing collection of, you know, we're just walking around the grounds here, and we've got Julian Thompson, the car designer here. We've got Etienne, the previous designer for Bugatti, and he's now created this incredible new Land Rover Defender, which is just amazing. It's just, everywhere you look, there's just really cool people surrounded by really cool cars and really cool works of art.
It's very nice, very chilled, and a lot of chatting about cars, about art. And that, for me, that's brilliant because that's my life, car and art and boats. And so it's brilliant not just to talk about cars.
Yeah.
This is another element to it, and that's what makes it different to most car events.
Yeah.
Well, for people that don't know your art, how would you describe it?
Like someone said, well, there's an artist, sadly I don't remember his name. Someone asked him, how long did it take you to paint this? And he said it took me 70 years.
Oh,
and wow. Even if it clearly took physically probably a month or whatever, but everything you do is the consequence of everything that's happened before.
Yeah.
And everything that's happened to me before I did this as a career is my involvement with so many cars and so many races and so many projects. Uh-huh. And I think I try to put this into my work. Like, the Jaguar we're talking about, for instance, obviously it's a photo, it's based on a photo I took when I was in Rome. Mm-hmm. The light was magical. Obviously my photo was nowhere near, you would have done something extraordinary, but it was a good enough iPhone photo to inspire me to, and that was what I wanted to capture. I had better photos. I had a unique one actually. When we finished shooting by the Vatican, the little bit where they drift around the Vatican, and I took the car back. So I drove the car back, and the big avenue that I forgot the name, that drives up to the Vatican, I drove the car up the avenue, which was obviously closed and still empty at very early in the morning. It was still dark. And I'm there on my own, and I'm looking around. I'm like, how many people are there? So I parked the car, and I took some photos with the Vatican on the back. I left the lights on the car, and I was just, that was magic. You know, but these things... is this magical moment that inspires you? So it inspired me to do that painting. There's one copy at Williams in the reception.
Amazing.
And it's the consequence of things that, and my life ever since I'm little.
Amazing.
He's been doing cars and stuff.
So just in case anyone's sat at home thinking, which film could we be talking about there with the Vatican? it's quite a famous film. So you were involved in the iconic villain car for James Bond Spectre, the CF-75.
Right. Yeah.
And this was a car... so was this a car that Williams built?
Yeah.
Right.
So obviously Williams, it's no secret that Williams' involvement in the Jaguar CX-75 in relation with Jaguar. So, but we built the car at Williams. And then when the movie people decided to use the Jag as the villain car alongside the DB10, then we were asked to build the stunt cars, because clearly the original CX wouldn't have lasted going down steps and jumping. So and we started building pretty quick, designed and built, because the design had to be from scratch.
Yeah.
Under the skin, it's a completely different car. So it's a kind of a race car. Amazing. Is a race car.
Yeah.
Really. A simplified race car with the skin of a Jaguar.
It must be, for me personally, I always think, obviously, being involved in a build for a Bond car must be a really cool thing, but when you get to be the villain's car, the baddie,
I know.
It's kind of a bit cooler, isn't it? Like, you just, that's a bit more special to me than, obviously, the DB10 was iconic, and I know that a lot of people spent an awful lot of money on the recreation models of them.
It's a beautiful car.
But the CX-75 is an interesting one, because we did a podcast only 2 or 3 months ago now with Ian Callum, who, of course, was the designer.
Of course, we worked together. Yeah.
Now, Ian, in the podcast with us, he said, we asked the question of, because, of course, many, many concepts get built that sadly don't make it into production. And we asked the question of, which is the car that you really wish went into production? And for him, it was the CX-75. That was very much his design. And if you're familiar with Ian Callum's designs, you'll see his styling, the way that he draws, the way he designs. It's all very much Ian in that car. So, I mean, what a privilege for you to be able to bring that car to life.
And in
the sense that, whilst it is a shame, absolutely it is a shame that it wasn't made into a car that we could have gone to Jaguar and purchased, it's a car that we all now know because of that amazing film.
It's got a good following, you know, a good bunch of fans of that car. Like, all of us are sad that it didn't get made, but, you know.
Completely.
They are complicated projects, you know. It was a very complicated car, the original one.
Yeah.
Very complicated.
Makes it so complicated?
Well, because it's hybrid. Mm. So it had a very powerful petrol engine, a small four-pot, 1500, 1600 turbo, but still pushing over 500 horsepower.
Yeah.
And then two electric motors, a big battery. So it's fully, it could be fully electric. Even electric is quite fast.
Mm.
And they are complicated cars. You know, there was 13 radiators for cooling various things.
Wow.
So all this, you know, pipe work, electric work, it was incredibly all carbon. Everything was obviously the tub. So
it was
designed like a race car and like a supercar, which is now more common. But then there was still not that many car to the extreme. I mean, we were doing the car the same time as Porsche was doing the 918, we're developing roughly at the same time.
Yeah.
And sadly, we were actually almost more advanced than Porsche at some point in terms of finalizing the development of the prototype. We even got compliments from the German guys at Bosch saying how good our prototypes were.
Wow. So let's go back to that time where the car has been selected as the villain car. Who makes that decision? Would that have been...
That was entirely Sam Mendes.
Sam Mendes, amazing. Yeah. So he saw the car and said, right, that's
so
the
we
one
went
I
to Pine. Again, I was lucky to be involved in that. I was on my own with the car and some lovely people from Jaguar, one of them, one of which works for Ian Cullum now, actually. And we took the car to Pinewood. The DB10 was there, the very first DB10. We parked the Jag. Sam Mendes came in a big hangar, the Bond hangar, whatever. And he said, okay, leave me alone with the cars. Everybody walked up. Everyone was there. I mean, Barbara Broccoli was there, the producers, everyone.
Yeah.
He said, I want some time alone with the car. So we went in the canteen. And then we got a phone call and he said, I take it. Wow. Literally, that is what's happened. The first meeting and then the second meeting, we went again to choose the color. So Jaguar did some amazing samples, painted curved panels with different colors that they selected, pre-selected. And then they choose the... They pre-selected a couple. They took them to Rome. They flew to Rome with the samples to check them in the street lights, see what it looks like. Because that's all going to be filmed at night,
as
you know.
Of course, yeah.
And these lights are very specific, you know, these yellow street lights. To decide which color would work best, I'm sure they did a bit of sample filming, and they went for the orange. We know very well.
Yeah, of course. So I have to know, what is the process in making a film car? Because I think so many of us at home would just assume that you would take... In usual circumstances, a car that's either already in production or about to be in production, and that's easy because you just take five or six from a production line. There you go. There's your film cars. You go away and film them. But ultimately, you had a car that wasn't being made.
It was
so you had
and,
to.
And the original car, obviously, there was no way we could destroy them. It was just testing.
Yeah,
and they were not obviously suited for the job because we already had some of the script that he was going to go down the steps. He was going to jump a wall. He was going to hit some motorcycle on the side. It was. Yeah. You know, they'll go up the wall by the river, and obviously a normal car would not be able to do that. So, but immediately after the meeting where they said, yes, we have the car, we had a big meeting. So luckily everyone is in Pinewood. So, you know, the stunt guys, the producers, so we had a big meeting around the table and they say, all right, let's kick it, basically. And they say, we need 5 stunt cars by Christmas.
Oh, wow. And when, what time?
He sunk under the table when he said that.
Wow.
And what was that space of time? When did they make the decision to take
that? That was in September.
Oh wow.
It was kind of now,
But that always seems to be the way of film and the film industry. It's like, can I have this massive thing next week, please? Thank you very much. Why can't you do it? Kind of attitude.
They have no limits. They have no limits, whether it's ideas or vision or whether it's budget or, you know, especially that sort of movie, of course. And they're not used to be told no.
No, of course.
It doesn't exist. I mean, in motor racing, it's rare, but in movie...
Yeah, of course.
It will cost you $1 million, okay? And, you know, it is just...
And how does it work with the with that side of things? Do they say, we'll give you some money up front to build them? Or do they say, right, you go away and build them, we'll pay you later? I can't
this
imagine...
This is out of my skills or... You know, my involvement, but obviously the Jaguars and the Astons were supplied by Jaguar and Aston.
Because, of course, it's the biggest advert for them isn't it?
There's a bunch of people, they're based in Pinewood. What their job is product placement.
Yeah.
They're very well connected and they basically link the two together. And they place that product and then it's up to Jaguar and us, in that case, to supply.
Wow.
So you get pressure from both sides, from our customer and from the movie production, and with all the crazy requirement that they need. It's not just 5 cars, but one of them is a pod car, you know, when they drive from the top. That's something else. So the pod car, we built the car so it could have a pod, but the pod itself was done by the guys from the movie.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah. Because they've done that a few times.
And is that where the actual driver is sat separately to the car? Yeah, so they're on top of a frame.
He drives on top and the actor is inside. Amazing. So the podcast is only used for the actor.
Yeah.
The actor doesn't always going. I mean,
no, he's in
but he's got a big camera in front of you. Yeah. He's got a camera on the side. There's screens. There's lights. It's the car is entirely surrounded by something, whether it's a screen or it's a light panel that changes, and cameras everywhere.
I don't know about you, but I think I'd get very, very travel sick in
that.
Yeah,
quite nervous.
I was lucky, Mark Higgins took me in at the test track. He took me in the podcast while doing donuts and things. You don't know where, and you keep turning the wheel, you know, because if you it doesn't do anything.
That's hilarious. It's almost like a roller coaster ride, but you can't.
At least
with a roller coaster, you can usually see where you're going. Your brain almost expects where you're going to go. Even with the, you know, you can expect what's going to happen. But the minute you've got somebody else completely taking control of the car that you are in the driver's seat of, with all the, you know, the gearing and the steering wheel in front of you, that must be very unnerving.
It's so strange, especially when you know how difficult it is to drive the pod car, because it's not a direct, it's not like the same steering wheel, it's a hydraulic thing, so
of course
it's a very strange link to the wheel. It's not completely direct, and but these guys are so skilled. They drive pod cars all the time and they know what to do with them.
Which, when you're doing certain stunts, like, you know, driving down the steps, do you think, okay, we'll try and make sure that this car can do that stunt a number of times? Because obviously you've only got five cars, and the amount of stunts that you do and the amount of times it might take to try and do them. Like, is it a case of you try to get that one shot in one shot, or do you have to do it a number of attempts?
We did it five times.
The steps one?
With the same car.
With the same car. Oh, wow. And the car was okay?
We broke the first time. So we had car lines up at the top in case... He could have ended up in the river, which he nearly did on the first time, because the car broke. Well, he hit the wall slightly, broke the drive shaft and a bit of the suspensions. But when you're flying down the steps, you don't know if it's broken or not.
Of course, it's just noise, isn't it?
And then at the end, he was a little bit out of control and the river was very close. So, but the car was broken and we had to drive it back up. There was a little path that you can drive back up. But it was a broken drive shaft parked next to the river. Right. So... the stunt manager, Gary Powell, lovely chap, said, okay, send another car. And we're like, oh my God, we're going to break five cars tonight.
In this one shot.
Yeah.
So I nearly got in trouble. I stepped out. I said, we can change the drive shaft before you guys are all reset with your cameras. Mm. You go half an hour. So went to the mechanic, guys, you go half an hour to change the drive shaft. Oh, it's not popular on the other side. And the Tiber had a bit of a flood. There's been a lot of rain before, so the water was actually coming almost like a tide.
Oh, wow.
And the mechanic had like the water coming behind him, and he was like, "No."
So they were fixing the car on the side.
Because we had to drive it back up.
So
we had to fix it. There was no way to drive it back up. And to drive it back up, you had to sort of jump the first step and then drift it around the corners because it was so tight.
Wow.
So you don't burn the clutch and the ears.
It's one of these things where we all watch those amazing car chases. Mm. And of course, the Bond franchise is just fantastic for car chases. Every single Bond film is an amazing car chase. And you watch these things, you never really consider that one scene, so the running down the stairs scene might have been 4 or 5 seconds of actual footage. Yeah. But to think that there's one or two entire evenings of filming, the potential of destroying five cars, having to fix a car that breaks on the first run. I have to ask, so at the end of filming, with all the different stunts, how many of the cars were in a state where they were actually drivable?
Well, they were sort of okay.
Okay.
All of them?
Yeah, okay. The body works, obviously, we went through a little bit of body work, and as you know, the final scene, the Jag is on fire, so that body work was quite burnt, and... But the cars were okay. I mean, they run now. Some people own them. I don't know how many, but they've been obviously refurbished a little bit. We burned clutches a lot.
Yeah.
Because it was a race car, because of the limited amount of time, we had to make decisions of what gearbox and to use, etc., for practicality. And We went through more clutches than anybody lifetime.
How many clutches do you reckon you went through in the making of the film?
God, I can't even count, honestly. Wow. It was several a night.
A night?
Yeah, my goodness me.
So what, like, changed them in the day. So we filmed that night and mend the cars in the day. It was a fantastic team.
Yeah.
Williams in the day mending everything that was damaged. So before I go to bed, I send like a job list to the guys in the day.
Did it start with, I'm really sorry, but dot, dot, dot.
And the first job was change the clutch on
and
change reverse gear and stuff like that.
And so the team, that engineering team, the mechanics, would they be Williams racing engineers?
Yeah.
Wow.
So there was a big team, obviously a team from the movie special effects department, mending mostly some of the nondescript car, like the little Mini, you know, that he pushes and you have to prepare that.
Oh, yes, so the old man driving.
That was so funny. He was a stuntman.
Really? Well, the old guy.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And I mean, that thing they practiced for nearly one day because what they did because the street was so narrow, you know, and kind of short, really, and cobbles and nights, and it's just at the back of the Vatican. And to push the car like this and make it so they had like a hook at the back of the
Mini.
The Fiat 500.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And a hook at the front of the Aston, and then once they clip on, they stay together.
Wow.
Otherwise, you know, it would be extremely difficult to do that, especially in that little street. I mean, we practice that on the test track, and it's fine. But
you know,
aiming for the hook and then keep going. I mean, there's so many things like that. You know?
How many? Yeah, thinking about that, the practicing side of things. Are these stunts practiced a lot on test tracks before?
Yeah.
Are there ever any things that can only be done? I don't know. Like
there's some of it, like hitting the mopeds. You know, when he goes off the corner, hits the mopeds. You do that then. You know, we only did two takes for that. It was really good. One of the takes, one moped just really flew up in the air, and the director's like, "Yeah, we did that one." the second unit director and photographer were. Fantastic. They were extraordinary, very professional. That's what they do. Mostly second unit, chase, you know, and stuff. They were incredibly efficient. Alexander Witt, he's done Pirates of the Caribbean and also very, very nice people. But the jumping off the wall, we did that then. When he comes off the wall.
That's right. And he goes, and is it an Alfa Romeo or something? He chops the top off.
That's funny as well. And, we practice jumps.
Yeah.
We practice the jump and we develop the suspension with the very clever people at XTC suspension to do the best jump. So it's not easy to jump a car properly. You know?
No, of course.
Especially when you go a narrow street to land in.
Mm.
So, but when you practice jumping, not practice jumping in a small street of Rome.
Yeah.
And that worked fine. That was one take.
Wow.
That was one take, I think.
Incredible.
Mostly because of the roof of the Alpha, that's it. When it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, of course. Can't really weld it back on and hope for the best.
No, because that was obviously prepped and attached to a crane and all sorts of things. But fascinating. They are very clever people. And the good thing with Bond, everything, what you see happened.
Yeah,
there's
of course.
No CGI.
That's right. And I think it's so easy to assume, especially with some of those really tight backstreet bits of footage, you think, oh, that must be so dangerous. So it must be easier just to do it in computer-generated imagery. But no, you go out and actually make it happen. Is this the first time you were in the film world?
Yeah, Okay. Some of our technicians did Casino Royale and So they were with the Aston at the time and destroying Astons. But
it's a bizarre job, isn't it, when you're responsible for building amazing cars that are immediately then going to be destroyed.
I know. I remember one of the chap that worked with us at Williams. He was involved in was it Casino Royale or the one after, where when he was asked to take a little hammer and punch some holes in the bodywork.
Oh, for bullet holes.
To make the bullets.
Oh, cool. My
God. And you're like, it's hard to do.
Apologising every time. I'm so sorry, bang.
But there's so much involved. And you think, why do they have so many people? But they all have a job and they all have something very important to do. Continuity and, you know, you guys filming, so continuity is super important.
That's right.
If the cars hit the moped, so it's damaged, Yes. That damage needs to be carried to all the scenes that actually happen after
that's
that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's filmed before, you know, so it's very...
Yeah.
Yeah, just the thought process,
incredible.
I guess.
It's incredible.
It's really difficult.
The writing process and the preparation is it's very impressive operation,
yeah.
I've got to say. And I've done Formula One, I've done... But movies, it's quite something.
Yeah.
Especially Bond, where it's analogue, it's there. It
happens, of course, of course. So in your time with Williams, you were the car build manager for Williams. That's obviously the CX-75 of the Bond film is a huge accolade to have. What else would we know you for? What other involvement in Williams?
So my last involvement at Advanced Engineering was the Singer, working with Singer on the DLS.
Of course.
Sadly, I left before the first real DLS, as you know it, the first prototypes were finished, but we're involved in the mule car that we all know, that grey car that's well battered.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
But that was a good car. That's a fantastic car because it's got everything, really. Mm. It just looks different. So that was quite intense too, but very, very interesting.
Yeah, I bet. And now you're predominantly art.
Yeah, that's that.
And how's that transition been for you? Is it...
Well, it was smooth enough that I was doing a bit before anyway.
Sure.
So when I was at Williams, I was starting painting stuff and selling. Luckily, thanks to the lovely chap at Octane, who gave me my first real
Octane
and
lovely
step.
Big lovers of Octane.
Thank you, David Lillywhite.
Thank you, David Lillywhite, yes.
No, David, yeah, was the first to sort of give me a little promotion, which was very lovely. And it's people still talking about it, so... That was very nice. You know, that first step, that's what you need, you know. Sometimes you need one of these in life.
I think especially when it comes to art and anything creative, it's very difficult to get your foot in the door, I suppose, without those people that do help you with the like a leg up. Because it's just trying to get there, really, I guess. Mm. And I think that's what's great about sleeping with art as well, is that it's giving all of these artists an initial leg up.
Exposure. So
that, because people, you know, it's always, I don't know about you, but being a photographer as well, people say to me, "Oh, hey, why don't you come and shoot this thing for me? It'd be great exposure for you." And you're like, it's hard that you don't want to be like ungrateful. You're like, yes, I do love the exposure, but I also do need to pay my bills. So, but there's that very fine line between thinking, actually, no, this is good for both of us and trying to, see what works. Yeah. So when you have got people like David Lillywhite, once Octane, now Magneto, it's those people that think, actually, this is a great, what I consider a true collaboration. So I guess for yourself as well, that it's wonderful that you could have worked in a world where you've been able to meet a lot of these people and just be able to produce something that you love and then have people that want to help you out and say, hey, let me
we met with David on the Bond you know, when the journalist was testing the cars and he did his paper on the Bond cars once they were released to the public and to the journalists. That's how we met, and we had a lovely day in Fenend, you know, the Jag testing track,
very close to where I live.
So we did quite a bit in Fenend also, and it's quite nice there actually.
It is.
And the tent with all the classic cars is phenomenal. So that's how we met, and we just stayed in touch. And you know, it's funny enough, when you're honest, you know, when you're honest with about what you do, who you are, and then people enjoy sharing and being alongside.
That's it. That's something we often talk about on the podcast. Is there's a lot of our listeners. We have a lot of younger listeners, teenagers, early 20s, a lot of people at the very beginning of their career. And this industry, whether you're going into it from a design point of view, engineering, artistic, PR, social media, photography, it can be so daunting and it can be so difficult to work out how to succeed in this industry. But everything you've just said there makes perfect sense. And this is something I've said time and time again. The art of being interested and interesting is often all you ever need to be.
Mm.
If you're a good person and you do good work, you will attract the attention of other good people that do good work. And whilst it can seem so vast and so broad and so daunting, ultimately, it's a really small community of people where everybody kind of knows everybody else. There's 2 degrees of separation between every single person in this industry. So what you've just said there is a perfect example of what we constantly preach here. And it's just go into it with an open mind, do a good job and be a positive person and be engaging and interested. And the rest
goes back to what I said, you know, it took me 50 years to paint these things because it's the evolution of what I've been doing. You know, I did my apprenticeship on Ferraris and, you know, and which is where my heart is. Still is. But But yeah, it's the evolution of life, you know, yeah. And I'm sure it's the same for you guys.
Yeah.
You
know, yeah.
Absolutely. That's where it takes you. So you have to ride it.
So what is that, before we round things up, what is that, firstly, what do you drive on the road? You might have more than one car, but what's the car that you enjoy? And also, if I could ask you to set a top three, and I know that's an impossible question to ask any true petrol head, because of course, if I said pick a top 100, you still struggle. But top three cars that you find really special, any age, and what's your daily car? What do you enjoy driving?
So one of them, I'm like Chris Harris. Uh-huh. I'm a big fan of the Passat Estate B5.
Really? Oh, the B5, right. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
And, oh, joke about it, but that's my workhorse. Uh-huh. I don't want to get rid of it.
Perfect.
I drive a 911.
Yeah.
Kind of daily, really. I drive my Porsche all the time, go to my printer with it. I deliver paintings with it when they fit. And,
perfect.
And that's, so that's my cars. And the old Land Rover.
Yes.
I've had great. Many, many Land Rovers. That's my ninth, I think. So series twos.
Brilliant.
Two A's. Cool. Yeah, I had many of them. The first car I bought when I moved to England is by a Land Rover.
Yes.
I always say, I'm going to buy a Land Rover. And it was a rainy day, very rainy day in the middle of nowhere in Coventry. And I had to drive through the country lanes. I'm like, what have I done? Kind of nearly the first time I was driving on the other side of the road or in this old Land Rover. My God.
Yeah, they're not quite responsive with the steering. So if you're on the wrong side of the road and heavy rain, it's...
Oh my God, the wipers. Yeah.
And yet you kept them.
And then I kept it for years, yeah. And then now we just, and my daughter's the biggest fans of Land Rover now, and because they grew up with them, you know, they were like brothers. So, so that's my, Land Rover 911. Like I said, my heart beats with Ferrari because of my involvement when I was young.
Yeah.
So a 308 GT4 is my next thing. Okay. I hope, to get one.
Before they start. Really, because they are going
they already my first boss was my mentor when I was young. Is Philip Gardet. There's lovely video on Petrolicious about him actually now. Mm. And he, what a legend. And and it's about his 308 GT4 actually that he's just restored. And and I drove one when I was a kid, when I was 18. This first car I drove after I got my license, he said, there you go, let's take this. So and it's always been, I love that car.
Lovely.
Just it's had up and downs in terms of popularity, but now it's definitely, so that'd be the top three.
Fantastic. Love that. So if anyone's listening, they want to look at your work, I've got your Instagram handle here and it's definitely worth checking out. It's nice and easy. JYT_bespoke_art. Get on Instagram and have a look at Jean-Yves's fantastic collection of work.
Thank you.
Really, really fascinating to have you here. If you haven't already started writing a book, let me give the recommendation that you do, and the title should be something about I destroyed the only Jaguar that didn't get made. So it's a working title.
I was quite lucky to drive them a lot as well. Yeah. The stunt cars, they were absolutely bonkers. I mean, the guys were the balls to drift them around the Vatican.
Mm. That's pretty cool.
Because that was quite so on cobbles, wet cobbles.
Yeah.
That was quite special. But luckily, I only drove them on tracks and, you know, drifting and doing stuff. It's good fun.
Amazing.
You have the best job.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's nice. Pretty cool. Well, I like what I do now. I really enjoy it.
Awesome.
I've got lovely customers.
Good stuff. Well, we're going to get back inside and I think we should go and have a look at some of your art. We will put some pictures of that up on our Instagram as well so you can enjoy Jean-Yves' work. And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fascinating talking to you. And
well, thanks a lot for inviting me.
Again. Pleasure.
Nice speaking to you guys.
I hope you enjoyed that, because next up we've got a very exciting artist called Johnny Ambrose. And if you wanted to follow along to this, his Instagram is johnnyambrose.autoart. Now, Johnny creates these incredible sculptures from all different types of material. And I mean, just skimming through visually what you can see now on his feed are little sculptures or these almost wire creations. And I mean, John, you love Johnny as well. So how would you describe his art?
Yeah, it's as you'll hear in this conversation, the thing I really love about it is it doesn't actually have to take the physical form of a car. You're not necessarily looking at a sculpture of a car exactly as you expect to see it, like a scaled down version. It might be structural shapes. It might be side profiles. It might be top down views, really quite striking sculptures. But the kind of thing where you look at, you instantly know what it is. So it's really, really cool. So, yeah, we wanted to dive into, ask Johnny a bit about his processes, what he thinks about his style, his conforming abilities when he was at art college and not necessarily always playing by the rules. But hey, look at him now. He's making amazing stuff. So yeah, johnnyambrose.autoart is the account if you want to have a little look whilst we have a chat with him now for this section of the podcast. Let's dive in and enjoy.
The Driven Chat Podcast in association with Paramex Digital.
Welcome to another section of our Sleeping With Art podcast, where we are sat in our pod that I don't feel like we've given enough description of. But if you imagine, as we were saying before we hit the record button, it's a bit like a monorail cabin. And Amy was talking about how she often parks in very swanky airports where she then has to look at other people riding in these pods.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like one of those, doesn't it?
Yeah, or like one of those, what is it, the skiing things when you go skiing and you get taken the lift.
The very big
ski lift. Big ones, yeah, but yeah. Like tiny version.
Expensive resort.
Yeah. Or this could also be one of those expensive resort things that you see in like Norway where you end up sleeping in the snow and under the stars. Yeah. One of those things. But yeah, it feels
definitely.
Quite
it's
nice
like it
nature.
Could be up in the tree canopy.
Mm-hmm.
And you could kind of be. Think, I hope they've secured it properly.
Yeah. And that is the lovely voice of Johnny Ambrose. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me here.
Pleasure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Pleasure.
Now, Johnny, we were discussing before, as John said, hit record button. We were trying to figure out how to define your job title. And I think we ended up on all-round artist.
All-round artist, yeah. I'm just an artist, I guess. And I love
so
making sculpture.
Just an artist, yeah.
Yeah, I love working in 3D rather than just 2D. I tried 2D and I tried painting, but I just hate that. Kind of like brush not being a definite thing. So, you know, 3D things, working in wood and metal and carbon fiber, you know, they're actual tactile objects that you can, you know, create with and make lots of mess generally.
Yeah. Well, the thing that jumped out to me when we arrived to the event yesterday was this beautifully huge, you'll tell me the dimensions in a second, I'm sure, but a Porsche 917 that's made out of, I looked at it and thought, it's almost like, and forgive me for this, Johnny, because this is a big underselling, but do you remember Kinects, where you had the little junctions of different angles where you could connect the long strands? It's like that, but it's carbon fibre, aluminium, and 3D printed individual knuckles. What would you call them? Are they
connections? Yeah, the different, obviously not trademark connections or whatever. This isn't available in the shops. This is it's all bespoke, and if I'd known how much work it would have been when I started, I might have had second thoughts, but halfway through, you know, there's no going back. It's like, got to see this through. But many hours in front of in CAD, staring into a screen and making my eyes go doolally, doing all the separate connections, so all the aluminium and carbon fiber rods match up exactly, you know, with accuracy. And it's lots of head scratching at times, but that's mainly to do with the sheer number of parts. You know, it's probably about 2,000 parts. So it's it's almost like, well, a 2,000 piece jigsaw, but slightly more interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, it worked because, of course, as soon as I arrived and saw the sculpture outside on the big table that you've got, I immediately said, oh, wow, look at 917.
Mm.
So it was recognisable to me.
Yeah.
It does help that I'm a huge geek, obviously. But it was
aren't we all?
Yeah. We all recognised it as one of the iconic Le Mans racing cars from Porsche. And it looks fantastic. So how long did it take? So I'm assuming, so just to describe this to the listeners, if you want to have a look at it, we've put a photo of it recently on our Instagram. If you'd like to have a look at it, you've got strands of carbon fibre rods and aluminium rods, and then you've 3D printed the connections that then do they slot into or are they clipped into?
Yes, they slot into, but it's to go into the fine detail, each connection has got a kind of star joint on with kind of tiny flanges which kind of give a little bit, so they kind of hold the rod in place.
Got you.
That's the real detail. but generally, yes, the chassis is all in aluminium, and then the body and the wheels are all in black carbon fiber, so it's got that mix of silver and black, if you like, so that you can read one next to the other. But I kind of like creating structures like that and 3D in general, because as you move around a work, you see a different composition of lines, so it's you can't always just
see it all in one go, if you like. You can, obviously, if you stand back, but it's almost like being in the front row of a cinema screen where it's like you're trying to see the screen in one. It's a maze. It's a maze of lines, as you've seen.
When you're looking at your sculptures, it's fascinating being here at Sleeping With Art because the sun is thankfully out, and so we can have a look at your pieces outside as well as inside. But also interesting for me on the ones inside, you have these certain shafts of light that are coming through some of the windows, and the way that light hits your sculptures as well. Is that something you ever think about when you're designing these things? Literally, the thinking when people look at these, where am I going to have light? Like for me, when taking pictures, I'm chasing light all the time. Is that something that you do? And how you're thinking these your pieces are going to be displayed? Is that something that's thought process?
I try to do that. I didn't know the venue before I came here, other than what was on the website. But I tried to display them so that they're either got good views beyond or a clearish background, so that you can see the form, you can see the silhouette of the piece. Because we can see a car from a distance, we instantly recognize what it is, because we're all geeky, aren't we? I don't feel too bad using the thing geeky. But so it's kind of trying to create that, so it's instantly kind of readable, but as you get closer to the work, you know, you can kind of see the depth. Seeing the light behind it, that's kind of nice, so you can see it from both sides, all around it. With the finishes of some of the materials, I'll try to get it so that the light bounces and causes shadows, and so it's that kind of play of the actual physical form versus the shadows that it creates.
Cool. Some of your pieces remind me, and I don't know if this is coincidence or this is what's thought of, but when people used to create the classic bodies over, you know, before they created the body, they used to create the book, the wooden book. When you had your, what looks like, if people don't know what a book is, it's basically a, I don't know, maybe a number of different profiles. Sections of a car. And then the idea is that people roll and fabricate these sheets of metal over these books. And your sculpture, Johnny, also remind me of that, because some of them are made from almost these slats of these profiles of cars. Is that something that came from inspiration from these original car making techniques, or how do they come about?
Yeah, very much so. I've always thought of bucks as sculptures in themselves.
They're beautiful.
And obviously some of them have been exhibited. Some of the Italian coach builders ones have been put on plinths. I think there's a wooden buck for the Modulo, the Ferrari Modulo. And also underneath the skin, the Ferrari under the skin exhibition at the Design Museum, they had the shark nose buck there and some others. And I spent longer looking at that than the actual cars, because that's what interests me. It's to see how they were constructed. But very much so. The ones which have the longitudinal planes, it's to try and capture that kind of streamlined effect of the car, and I think breaking it into longitudinal sections aids that kind of, not just the streamlining, but the elegance of the form as well. So it's kind of manipulated so that it's made even more elegant. I kind of love aerodynamics, or imagining what the airflow would be doing. So it's kind of aids that and kind of makes it sleeker and, in my mind anyway, more elegant.
For sure. And also going with the aerodynamics, some of your other pieces, people should really just be like scrolling through your website or your Instagram when we're chatting this, because then they can see what we're talking about.
Radio's great for describing
visual art,
isn't it?
But if some of the pieces, that the idea of airflow is, you have like the car on one side of your sculpture of the car on one side of your piece, and then you almost have these long waves of material that come off of the back of the car, I guess, to represent airflow. Is that correct?
It's so I kind of always been interested in aerodynamics, and when aerodynamics was becoming a thing, certainly in F1, you know, with the early Adrian Newey designs in the early 90s, and this coincided when I was doing a fine art degree kind of thing, and I was creating all these kind of swoopy sculptures then, quite big ones as well. But I don't think my tutors kind of got what was in my mind anyway. And they thought, it's not fine art enough, maybe. With the airflow imagined behind it in kind of strips of wood, that which is steam bent. So I... Uh, I went to a guy who does a lot of steam bending thing, and his work is shown at the Chelsea Flower Show every year in these amazing constructions. And steam bending is an ancient art, goes back to ancient boat construction, very simple boat construction. But it just softens the molecular structure in the wood, so you can bend it around quite acute angles or jigs, and you can twist it as well. And by twisting them, I'm kind of imagining that's what the vortices of the air is doing behind. So it's not a direct representation of what the air is. Any CFD person who works in F1 would laugh at it and go, "That's not right." But I don't care.
It's a great thing with art, is that it's artistic license. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, I use the artistic license a fair bit.
So you mentioned your let's go back to the studying days and your tutors maybe not quite understanding your vision of what you were hoping to achieve. And I know that this is something we often talk about on the podcast we have on the radio show as well, where we have a lot of listeners who are of an age where they're still studying. They're still at a point in their life where they're looking ahead to a career that they're looking to go into. And as somebody that studied art myself, I remember kind of being stuck in that same situation of I often had these ideas and these visions and these concepts in my mind, but because it didn't necessarily conform with what the tutors were trying to push us along with, I often found myself almost getting shot down a little bit. Can you cast your mind back to that era and think, was the vision strong enough for you to go, "Trust me, I know what I'm doing here. I know this is going to work." Or was there a bit of having to conform and then finding your own way later on?
To a degree. I think I was quite lucky that actually I had one really great tutor who was very supportive but made me think also and think about ways of changing things, which I wouldn't, you know, that's part of learning, isn't it? But also I've always been the kind of person that once I have an idea, I have to kind of try and push it through to completion. And it might be wrong at the end of it, but you learn from those kind of mistakes along the way. A kind of determination to just do what ideally I want to do and not compromise if possible. You have to make compromises to a certain degree, particularly if we're on commissions, absolutely. But I get the most satisfaction from doing pieces which I want to do.
Sure.
And I want to do it in a particular way, which is, the large 917 is the result of that. It's just like, I wanted to do that, even though it's taken a lot of time.
Yeah. Did you say before I saw you just on the first day of the event, so yesterday morning, and I think you said you were up until the early hours.
Yeah.
Just before it got here, piecing it together.
Yeah. I kind of laugh. Unfortunate at, the just-in-time kind of industries that are floundering now, but I'd like to say it was all planned to perfection. But when you're doing a bespoke build and it's something that it's a process which you haven't done that particular process through on such a scale before, you kind of added contingency. But so 1 a.m. I completed it on morning of the show, 3 hours up at 5 to get here in order to get it on the plinth in time.
When it comes to, the pieces that you do create, they at the moment, or the ones we've seen here, are all a similar kind of size. They're not really any bigger than this large table. Would you ever like to, do you ever play with size in your art? Like, would you like to be able to create something very, very tiny, or in comparison, something so much, much, much bigger than what the original subject might be? Like, what kind of do you think about, when you're thinking about the future of your art, I suppose, is there anything that you're thinking, "Oh, I'd love to have a go at doing that one day"?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the a big inspiration for me has from the very first Goodwood event, because that was local to where I grew up, and just seeing the first Jerry Judah sculpture in front of the house there, and it's like, wow, that is what is inspiring for me, things which kind of make you stop and look again and think, and you're just left speechless. So things like that, I'd love to do something on that scale in the future, certainly. And I was chatting to someone, and like you mentioned, with the works, which are the car and then the flowing steam bent wood behind it.
Mm.
I'd love to do, say, with the Lotus Avaya, which I think is a fantastic design, fantastic with the tunnels through it. And it's similar to the Valkyrie, which you can, and this is what I mean about imagining the airflow. It's just like you can see what the initial design ethos from Adrian New was in that with the Valkyrie. But with the Avaya, I'd love to do something like that, where you've got the car form, but then you've got the streaks of wood on a grander scale flowing through the sculpture. Mm. You know, something like that. And I will do that.
You could almost have it as just the aerodynamic vortices. So just the effect of downforce, you almost cancelling out the need to show the car in any way.
It's like a negative space car with just the airflow.
Because I am always fascinated by looking at downforce cars racing in the rain. Because that's one of the only times, unless you see the car in a wind tunnel environment, where you actually see what downforce is doing, and it throws water almost vertically in some spots.
Absolutely.
These huge rear wings or front splitters and front wings on downforce cars, like Formula One cars, and you see this dramatic movement of water. And I always think, I wonder if there's a way that that could be captured somehow, because it does look so fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, and it's interesting you mentioned that, because that... and loving F1 and seeing those classic shots of particularly the old wings, which used to throw up these massive kind of twists of like air, but only shown up in the rain.
It's
almost like, it'd be invisible normally.
Yeah.
But it's like, wow, what is that? And then it gets your mind racing and to think what else is happening, which you can't see normally. So
do you ever, having so much inspiration from such a variety of corners of the world and automotive world, do you ever feel like you have to stick to a certain style, or do you feel you have got the freedom to be able to change what your work looks like? Like from my own photography, I think, okay, I'm now known for this style, I better stick to that because that's what works. Do you ever feel the same, or do you have a much better feeling of freedom at all?
I'd like to think I have the kind of freedom, and actually I've thought about this, and I mean, my work, I suppose, is evolving all the time, because I have numerous ideas and I think, well, that is too far from removed from what I'm doing now. And it's kind of like, how can I link that to the work I'm doing currently? And but equally, I don't want to just do the same thing over and over and repeat the same style. It within, you know, so I try to mix and match, say, materials or various things like that. But it's tricky because, yes, you're perhaps known for a particular style, but I don't know. I'm not sure I have one distinct style. I'd perhaps try to vary it so that I don't get stuck on just doing one thing, perhaps. And there's nothing wrong with that, obviously. But for me, I think I'd get bored if I had to do the same particular sculpture 100 times or something.
Sure.
Which is why I try to limit them to just 9 of any.
So it's not out of being limited edition, you know, major expensive. It's because you get bored and you're like, I don't want to.
It's not so much bored, but equally, because I have so many works I want to create in, you know, the coming months and what have you, that I don't want to perhaps, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but get burdened with just doing that same work over and over and then not being able to do the works which I want to do next, if that makes any sense. It's a balancing act, because there's never enough hours in the day, you know, because it's, you're just working, it's just me, there's never enough hours in the day.
Mm-hmm. Does most of your work come as a customer says, I would like this, or do you produce the pieces, then people buy them? And I suppose with that as well, do you ever have to go looking for custom, or is that something that people are like, I love your work, I want to have a piece of your work? How does it work with your customers?
I suppose I'm fortunate that I don't have to. People come to me generally. I do a fair amount of work, which... Like I say, I've created because I want to create that particular car. I love that particular car, so I want to do that. And then people say that and can say, oh, can you do that this particular car in that style. And it's like, yeah, absolutely, that would work. Sometimes it won't always work, and I have to think around. It's like, well, let's do this slightly differently. But generally, yeah, people generally come to me, I think.
And who is, do you have a typical buyer? Who, or is it?
Yeah, repeat customers.
Yeah, who, I do. Who buys your work?
I do have some very good repeat clients, I'm happy to say. It's anyone and everyone, really, I suppose. What's really nice about doing this event and any event that I do, it can really surprise you, and you have the most amazing chats with the people that you least expect, you know. And people have always got great stories about the cars they've owned, and that's what's really interesting about this industry. It's not just the cars, it's the people and their stories of ownership and the trials and tribulations of them as well.
Have you ever had anyone come to you and say, have you made this particular model? Is it, for example, someone ever come to you and say, I've got a real strong personal affiliation with, oh, I don't know, BMW Z3 M coupes.
just off the top of your head.
Pluck that out of the sky. does that happen? Do people come along and say, can you make me a sculptor of, maybe not my car necessarily, but a Z3 M coupe? Or other cars are available?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yes, they do. Not great. That particular one as yet.
Watch this space, guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly if I think a car form, that particular car design would work as the inspiration for one of my pieces, and, you know, where its styling, its proportions, and design cues can be transferred and interpreted in a great way.
Yeah, and we're so lucky, aren't we, in the car world, and especially when we get to the kind of geeky, nerdy levels for us huge in-depth car fans. I remember that brilliant game they used to play on Top Gear years ago, the very first few series of the newish format, where, if you remember, they would take a snapshot of an intricate part of a car and slowly zoom out, and you had to guess, and you say, oh, it's an indicator from a TT or something like that. And yeah, a lot of people at home going, oh yeah, I was quite ashamedly quite good at that, actually. But we're all very good as car people at identifying very specific models of cars, even years of cars, by just a side profile or just a top-down profile or a rear shape. And without the definition of lights or windows, we just look at it and go, oh yeah, there's a Aston Martin Zagato, or, you know, we just identify it. So it must be fascinating do you ever explore that and try and make a car look as vague as possible, but people are still like, oh yeah, no, series body type, easy peasy.
Yeah, it's nice to kind of strip it back to the basics.
Yeah.
And almost imagine, I mean, I'm a kind of frustrated car designer in a way, you know, and I actually applied to to do the RCA course, and looking back now, it's just like, what was I thinking? It was just like, absolute rubbish. I was, but with sculpture, you don't have those kind of the problems of functionality to worry about. So it's kind of just pure expression. And I try to think, particularly with the classic designs, you know, whether it be a Gandini design or something like that, try to think, well, the final car was, you know, a Miura is inherently beautiful, but modern designs, obviously there's some great modern designs, you know, like the Valkyrie is a pure sculpture, if you like, but still it has to conform to road regs, things like that. But without that, you try to think inside. I try to think, what would the designer, what was its initial sketch? Was it lower, sleeker, lither, before the need for ground clearance and the practicalities of having to have lights at a particular height and all those boring elements, you know, and try to strip it back to the basic form and the design.
We previously spoke with Etienne Salomon, who is famously one of the top designers for Bugatti and now is working on all sorts of different things, including yachts. And I asked the question to Etienne and said, what would be your comparison as a car designer into from the realms of the artistic side of designing a car in comparison to the artistic side of just creating art? And he gave a brilliant example of, in car design, you're working on grid lines or dots, and all the dots must be joined. And in art, you have the freedom to just do whatever you want to do. So you're with what you've just said, you've made it very clear that you're definitely the latter. You're the freeform.
Absolutely.
Keep those dots far away. Dots and straight lines. Yeah.
I think I would. Yes. I've got lots of friends who are from doing the Coventry Transport course, which is close to where I am. Lots of friends who work in the industry still, and also those that chose not to. And I think I would have been frustrated with all the rules and regs, and it's just like, but why does an indicator have to be there? It ruins the line, you know, it ruins the form.
Yeah, so, I agree. I think I'd be exactly the same. Yeah, I'd be too grumpy about somebody in a suit going, sorry, but no, you can't put a 14-foot long wing on the back. I'm afraid that's just unacceptable. Yeah. So how has this event been for you? Because this has been the first ever Sleeping With Art event. And we know, I think, almost certainly there's going to be spin-off events by Renata in a similar vein to this. And, of course, she's planning on bigger and better event for next year. Has this been as you expected, better?
Better.
Well, yeah?
Better. It's been great. It's been great. And just for meeting the people, I mean, it's an idyllic location, great setting for the event. At the Moore Estate, but it's about meeting people. It's about like catching up with like friends, fellow artists, but also like I said earlier, about meeting people and have those really interesting interactions with them and learning things you didn't know about a particular car or what have you.
Yeah.
But and also some of the artists from overseas, like Etienne Franzak and his wonderful Lotus 25, which I was so looking forward to seeing, and it didn't disappoint. It's fantastic. He's a great guy as well. So,
yeah, I've always been fangirling as well over the photographer Rio Cam. So to be able to come here and be inspired and meet people, in my case, get people I admire their work of. It must be quite lovely and inspirational for you to be able to come here and be like, oh, that's cool. I like the way you've done that. And, you know, to be able to actually up close see other people's creations. Is it inspirational or is it, oh, I need to do this better, or I've got the whole thing nailed? Like
no, it just what you say, it's inspiration. It really is inspiring, and it's so great to meet all the other artists. I was joking with some of the others, it's almost like an artist's annual conference. We're all meeting up, which we haven't had a chance to do in absolute ages.
Yeah,
but obviously some of, I know quite a few of the guys that are UK based, but it was really nice to meet like I said Etienne and some of the other guys from elsewhere, from Germany, from the US, etc. but it is inspiring to see other people's work, and you kind of think, wow, and just look in admiration at that, and that's what I think. It's the eclectic mix of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is really great.
It's nice, isn't it? I often think that when I meet fellow creatives, you do pick up an energy off other people, don't you? And I think, as you say, so many of us have been locked up in our own homes or our own studio spaces, or we've seen just some close relatives, really. It's not until you come to an event where there are other people, like-minded people, that think the same way that you think, that don't quite conform to the usual societal ways of working, that you then go, oh, yeah, I'm one of these people. This makes sense. I'm not a complete lunatic, because I'm solely trying to make a living out of just creating things. It's reaffirming, isn't it, when you're able to rub shoulders with people that think the same way that you do. It's really cool.
Yeah, particularly when you enjoy something, what you're doing, and you're amongst like-minded people, which have that sort of commonality of overlapping interests. But that in itself is inspiring, because, you know, it doesn't feel like it's not work being here. It is obviously, and it's meeting people and making connections as well. But I just enjoy it because it's amongst like-minded people, and you can chat about art and chat about design and other things and cars and get sometimes to a far too geeky level, but we'll gloss over that. But, you know, generally just have really inspiring conversations, just having fun.
Yeah.
Cool.
Fantastic. Well, this has been great. Johnny, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
We will undoubtedly see you again. I hope we're not going to wait a year before we see you at the next Sleeping With Art event, but we'll see you out and about. Now, we usually record our podcasts, our regular listeners will know, we record our podcasts at Caffeine and Machine on a Tuesday, and there's plenty of your work to be seen there, isn't there? It's on the walls at Caffeine and Machine, both in the on the ground floor around the kind of bar restaurant area, but also in some of the rooms And you also attend multiple events, don't you, where you showcase your work and sell your work. So
I'm very fortunate. It's only 15 minutes from me.
Perfect.
And I've been lucky enough to have my work there from when they started, which I think are coming up to their 3-year anniversary now.
They are. Yeah.
That's wonderful. So if people wanted to find your work, where can they find them?
JohnnyAmbrose.com and on Instagram, JohnnyAmbrose.artist. Yeah, those are the things. And, of course, Cafe Machine and various other places. So
go take a look and spend some money. Johnny, thank you so much.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
And there we go. That was Johnny Ambrose. Lovely, lovely, lovely man who has followed up since our conversation and said, when are you coming along to the workshop? And I think we should definitely do that and go down with some
cameras
and things and just have a look, because I imagine it's full of wood dust and just cool bits of 3D printed.
I'm imagining it's
going to
be one of those like, you know, mystical lights coming through. It's like a shard of light through a top window somewhere. It'll probably be some really like high tech, super clean workshop or something like that. But, you know, a girl can dream.
Absolutely right.
The camera.
Find out soon enough.
Well, I'm looking forward to our final conversation with Etienne Salomone. Etienne Salome. Salome?
I think it's Salome.
Salome. He did say this.
He did. In the podcast you're about to hear.
Well, I mean, Etienne is an incredible designer. And whilst at Sleeping With Art, he and his team have produced this very exciting Series 1 looking Land Rover. Well, I suppose it's still a Defender, isn't it? But it's got the lights are kind of closer together like you would find in the Series 1. And interesting things such as no door handles, which I thought was a beautiful design. Also, no filler cap in the back, and that's in the very, very back, kind of in the pickup area. But you'll hear more about this car and the design and the thought process behind all of this, because Etienne started, well, a large part of his career was with the very beautiful Bugatti.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Etienne was responsible for having huge involvement in both the EB110, which is a real icon, but then also onto the Veyron and into the Chiron era as well. So, as design cred goes, there aren't really many other iconic cars you can think of. So to go from Bugatti to now start designing his own products like this Defender, and as you were about to hear, yachts as well, I think it's really cool. So yeah, if you want to enjoy this conversation, if you want to have a look at Etienne's social feeds, Etienne_gallery, Etienne_gallery. That's what you're looking for. Again, if you're struggling, just have a look at our Driven Chat account and see who we're following. You'll see Etienne fairly close up to the top. So yeah, enjoy this, and we will speak to you for one last time in just a little bit.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital.
Welcome back to the Driven Chat podcast, where I am sat here with my lovely colleague, John Marker, and our wonderful guest, Etienne. How are you doing?
Very good.
So Etienne Salome, I'm saying that right, is that correct?
Perfect.
Has got a wonderful career behind him and also ahead of him. But the thing I suppose people know you or may know you for is that you were a designer at Bugatti for 12 years, is that correct?
Correct, 12 years was my last sort of hoo-ha, being the La Voiture Noire in sort of the last Geneva Motor Show 2019. And being sort of a one of 1,500 horsepower W16 quad turbo, and yeah, having been sold for more than 17 million.
Wow.
So that's basically like, you know, being quite, the top of my career at Bugatti. And then, after these, 2019, I left the company to pursue like my own drive and my own what I wanted to do for my life, and because I always thought, what am I going to do after this? How am I going to beat that?
I suppose that's one of the most difficult things about being such a success. People who are successful in their careers, once you reach the top of your career, the thing that you think, what, you know, as a child you might think, one day I would love to be able to do, I don't know, this job or work for this person. And then especially if you reach that goal quite early in your life, you know, maybe mid-30s, then you think, well, hang on a second, what do I go and aim towards now? So after, you know, being at Bugatti for that long and then thinking to yourself, okay, what is now my next goal, my next desire to try and achieve with my life? Was that something difficult to try and understand, or was that something easy?
It's not difficult to understand, but at least difficult to put an actual picture on it. Mm-hmm. As I'm like, you know, a designer and like super only visual person. And yeah, I communicate with my drawings and this is like, you know, my life. So then I thought, what is it? How do I do something as a product like better than that car? Then I thought, okay, if it's more luxurious, if it's more power, if it's more, it cannot be on the road. And then I thought, like, okay, I started my own company called Salome Yacht and Design and started to design my own yacht. And it's called Atlantic by Salome Yacht. And I presented it in 2019 as a concept during the Monaco Yacht Show and then basically carried on. And we are nearly finished, you know. And this, the last 2% is the most difficult one. And I can ensure that this is true. hopefully we start the build into the shipyard in beginning of next year. And yeah, maybe with a little bit of luck, you know, being at the Monaco Yacht Show next year with my boat,
bearing
my name. I always dreamed, you know, I see some people that I worked with like, you know, Mate Rimac, or like I worked with doing the interior of the Gemera with the team from Sasha Selipanov and, you know, working for Christian Koenigsegg. It was fantastic because for me, working for Christian was like actually working for Ettore Bugatti, but being alive.
Yeah. Wow, yeah.
And then I realized, well, Christian company is 25 year old. Mate Rimac company, Rimac is like 10 year old. If they can do it, then I can.
Yeah.
And then it really struck on me, okay, but if I do a new car company, there's already so many of them. Mm. And actually, you know, it's we arrive to like sort of like an intersection for car design, which is coming sort of, you know, either right or left, you know? And then you would have the full electric, autonomous, semi-autonomous, you will have hydrogen, you will have all of those turned right, you know? But you will have some people that will always search for something as an experience, something more emotional, something that... And I think there is really two different paths for what is it, the future of the automobile. And then if you think about it, it was like, you know, I get a little bit more geeky, but like Euro 7 emission restrictions and everything, this is making as an automotive designer a total headache.
Yeah,
there's so many restrictions.
I suppose is it difficult because, sorry to interrupt, but we talk about sometimes design at the moment of car design and concept cars are stunning. But then when we sometimes see the cars that go into production, we think, oh, that's a little bit disappointing sometimes. And it must be the most disappointing for you as the designers yourselves, because you're like, no, this, we have so many ideas that we want to be able to create, but all these legislations mean that we can't. Is that something you have to battle with every day, I guess?
When you work for a big OEM, like, you know, Volkswagen Group, and like, you know, which Bugatti used to be part of that, you know, this is something you have to fight all the time. And this is, I had so many people asking me, why is it 17 million for a car? How come? And yeah, okay, there are some answers you can give, but I would like to be able to give, like, you know, tailor-made, one-off or a few-off, and that with a different, you know, solution. We are here in Sleeping with Art, like, you know, it's a small event, super cozy, like a lot of nice people, and I don't know, this is very enjoyable. And I'm here today to, well, yesterday we did the launch, so today we have the car as a Land Rover, sort of, you know, as a Defender. It's actually rebuilt by the company Arconic, which is 2.5 hour drive from here. And that car is totally amazing. It's like the total opposite of like what I've done in the past, which is always like more is more. And now it's actually the less but better.
So you yesterday showed me around, as you've just said, we're at Sleeping with Art, and you showed me around this Land Rover that you have changed and morphed into something very, very beautiful, because we're very used to the Land Rover shape being a boxy kind of shape. But I think John has mentioned that it's sometimes Land Rovers, especially Defenders, no panel is ever truly flat. You look down the light line and it's always a little bit wobbly and a little bit dented. But you look at your Land Rover that you've created and you've designed it in such a way that every panel is beautiful. The lines are so sleek. If you look down the side, there's no door handles on the outside, which I think is fantastic, or a petrol cap. What was the thought process behind this Land Rover, thinking, you know what, they're already quite simple machines, but we can make this even more simple, even more refined and unique. What was the thought process at the beginning?
Well, Defender is already very archaic and is already very limited, you know, so it's much more agricultural, if I can say, you know. And the moment you start to think from a design philosophy, a design is finished when there's nothing left to take out, then I went really to the extreme in sort of this Bauhaus movement and this idea of like, well, it's a machine in the end, but the least you have, the cleaner it will be, the better it will be for the customer. And in the end, you know, this is like still a 3.9 liter V8 with like a 5-speed manual, and this would be intoxicating to drive. We were just planning to like, you know, do a photo shoot, and we are speaking about being on the sand and being like with the fire and with like, you know, in evening and lights on. And this is really something that is making me happy, because in the end, I have the feeling we're going to do, you know, this is a limited of 5 units of that car. And this was really a big challenge to have the company Arconic to build this car. They have already 120 cars plus on order. The next 2 years, fully order books are full. And then they said, no, Etienne, if you come to us, we'll find a way, we'll make it work. And I think that was really like, you know, super enjoyable to make that process of the last 12 months and arrive with making the launch of the car here. And I think one of my favorite part of the car is obviously the front, which is inspired by like a Series 1, which has the completely closed front fender. Mm. And I move the headlamps within the front mesh, which makes it like, you know, very dark area. And then you don't see even the headlamps, which is really like sort of a counterflow of what you would normally do on a modern car design, where you would always place the light all the way to the outside with some daytime running light and creating width and creating like aggressivity. And this car just does not need it. And I have the feeling like, you know, with this car, I'm getting a little bit closer to this like motorcycle feeling and to all those things which I like. I like to do a product, and I think like, you know, I would sort of sum up this product as high cycling. So this is the chassis of a 1989 Defender, and it's completely, it had already a life. It had already, you know, and it's, instead of recycling, we take it and we put it to the next level. We take it and we put it even more, like, you know, precise and even more, like, you know, of all the details. And in the end, the whole sitting area, is everything is trimmed with denim. I just have the feeling it's going to be like a nice bottle of red wine, just going to get better with the time.
Yeah, appreciate.
Yeah. And be appreciated. And yeah, in the end, it's just going to go better and better. It's not going to be something that needs to be done with recycling material. I just don't want to throw it away. Mm. Never. It's something that I would like. My daughter, Lucia, is 8 years old. You know, how do I transfer to her this passion of the automobile? And I think that, you know, me and her going for a little drive on the beach, like, you know, with the dog in the back and everything, and yeah, hitting the road. And I think she'll get it. She'll get it why I am passionate about that, and I think this is important.
Yeah, I'd like to explore just on that level. I know we don't have a lot of time with you, Etienne, but just on the basis that we're here at this art celebration, we're surrounded by beautiful cars, but of course beautiful sculptures and beautiful creations and artwork. We've mentioned a couple of times when talking to car designers and on our recent radio shows, we've discussed the collaboration between the design process of a car and the art world. And of course, it can be so easy for us as consumers to look at a new car that comes out. And Bugatti is a perfect example, because, of course, the one thing that everybody gets excited about with Bugatti is power, power, performance, speed. It's got, you know, the amazing W16 engine, and it can 0-60 in this time and the stopping distance in this time. But often I feel the saddest part is, whilst we all appreciate the form of a car, we can all say, oh, that's a good looking car, or oh, I'm not sure about that. The actual process that goes into making that car look the way it does at the point that you are buying it in a showroom, how does that translate for you as a designer? Do you think of the process purely as a, I've been given my job and this is what I'm fulfilled and here to do? Or is it an artistic process in the same way that you would be if you were painting a picture or drawing a sketch of anything?
Comparing automotive art, which is design, and actually fine art, is like really walking on thin ice, you know. So like, it's a very sort of, you know, tricky question, you know, because obviously I'd like to tell you like I'm more an artist than a designer, you know, but then it always depends, like, you know, it's just like a rope, you know, it's like, you know, two ends, like you can, if you pull on one side and the other one. So all I have to say is that I believe the difference between art and design is that design consider a white page with a few dots and you have to have the task to make a straight line.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to have to make compromise. Some of the points you're not going to reach, maybe the line will not be completely straight, but you know, this is design. You have dots and you have to make a line going through. With art, hey, you make it for yourself. The page is always completely white. There's never any compromise you have to do. And I think that is the biggest difference. So when you do a car, there'll be four wheels, there'll be an engine, there'll be the recommended, there'll be restriction, there'll be this, there'll be that. There will always be dots on your white page. And as much as you can get closer to art with automotive, you know, like, hey, a 250 GTO is going to still be art on wheels, you know, but this is always like the way you see it with your own eyes.
Of course.
And not like, you know, somebody else telling you it's the way you experience that. And this is, again, why I like to make this new project, which I have the feeling I'm making a better world, you know. I have the feeling I'm making something that the customer is going to enjoy. The customer is going to sit in that Defender and go like, wow, now I feel really good. I have my hair, like, you know, in the wind. And like, yeah, my daughter is with, my dog is in the back. Like, everything is under control. I have the sound of the V8. I just feel this will be a great experience. And so, yeah, I think that's a good sum up of where I am and what am I doing those days, like, you know, experienced designer.
I love the emotional side to why you design and the thought process that you have in that. And yeah, the image of you and your daughter and your dog, that's, I think, is something that people don't always think about when they're thinking about either buying their car. It might be for a performance reason or for practicality, but less so for an emotional reason. I really like that's the way that you designed that Land Rover. So thank you so much for sharing with that.
Well, I always, as a last word, you know, I always, when I do design, I always design for myself. and I always think, if I would like it, you know, then chances somebody else would like is pretty high.
That sounds great. Fantastic.
Well, thank you so much for having me here today.
Pleasure. Thank you for joining us. And there we go. That's this week's podcast. Thank you so much for listening, dear listener. We are all still here with you and we're all going to say a big collective thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, there's pressure. I really enjoyed that. Those were chats I wanted to be in, but I'm really pleased to have heard them. Nicely done, you two.
Yeah, it was good fun.
Shall we tease a little bit of next week's show or should we just hang fire?
I say tease. Go for it. Do a tease.
Oh, no, now you're looking at me like to tease it. Well, I mean, it is going to be, it is me chatting with, I'll drop it in there. I've started a little thing called an E-Type restoration workshop, which so far I've not really talked too much about. So next week we're going to be, I'm going to be chatting with my both partner and business partner, William Haynes. And if you are a Jaguar fan, you may also already know the name William Haynes, but not my other half, but the grandfather of William, who was the chief engineer of Jaguar when Jaguar became Jaguar. So it's very nerdy. There's lots of chats about history and E-types and Jaguars as a whole. So if this sounds like your kind of thing, do tune in next week. And we're going to chat to you from the workshop.
I think this is really exciting. There will be no John Markar and no me. It's just Amy and her partner telling us all about it from the ground up. So for those of you, we get lots and lots of people that sort of share with us that they're new to the industry, they want to weigh in. Lots of people obviously follow because of Amy with her photographs and so on. Some people ask about broadcasting and things like that. Some people just want to know what it means to be a car expert like John Markar. But there are plenty of you that I'm sure, even if you just have a passing interest in what it is like taking an empty space and filling it with machines that you're converting, and everything that entails, from the unexpected bills to the oil on the floor, well, Amy's living it right now, so she's going to share it with you next week. That will be next week's Driven Chat podcast. Good luck. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, same.
Bye then.
Bye.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Oh, wow. You've made it to the end. The very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven podcast in your preferred podcast app, or head on over to the website driven.site to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.